I'm John Thwaites and I'm chairing this session. John Thwaites, Chair of the Monash Sustainable Development Institute and Climate Works Australia. And this is an opportunity to hear from some of the world's leading experts on cities, but particularly on how cities are leading in climate change. We're in a context where, unfortunately, in the United States, we've seen President Trump recently take the United States out of the Paris Agreement. And even I saw recently to go so far as to scrub climate change off the EPA website, which is sort of some sort of modern day book burning. But what we're hearing at the conference already today is that cities are actually in some ways mobilised by that type of action to take even faster action on climate change. And cities working with subnational governments are making it very clear that they are 100% backing the Paris Climate Accord and indeed saying we have to go even faster. And that was one of the messages that Aroma Revy gave this morning. So for this session now, I'm going to ask each of our global experts to speak just for about 2 minutes, if that's okay, on how cities are accelerating action, how they're working with other levels of government and with business and their communities to do that. And then it'll be a chance for people in the media to ask questions. So I'd like to start with Deborah Roberts, as well as being the co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 2, is also a working local government public servant at the eThekwini Municipality in South Africa.
Thanks, John, and good afternoon to everyone. I don't know how many of you attended the session this morning, but certainly there was a great underscoring of the fact that cities have been active in this space for a very long period of time. Firstly, claiming their space at the climate table, in order to have the opportunity to talk to their colleagues at the regional and national and international level about the importance of local action. But more recently, having been successful in that, so if we look at the Paris decision text, which supports the Paris Agreement, there's a very clear recognition not only of cities and subnational governments, but also civil society and private enterprise, beginning to mobilize around that more important issue of implementation. And what is critical to that implementation? Because we just don't pull implementation out of the hat like a rabbit out of a magician's hat. It needs to be informed. And one of the big missing pieces in this very complex climate action jigsaw puzzle is the role of science in informing the way that we develop cities. So cities have planned their space at the table, but in order to be a participant in this process, they are also claiming their right to a new knowledge space. They want to be part of the scientific discussions around how cities can mobilize and act appropriately. And that means being part of processes like, for example, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So I'm probably one of the examples of that level of activism. This is the first time that a local government official has been an IPCC co-chair. They're generally long-term, well-established research scientists. But I think that's a recognition that not only do we have to welcome cities to the policy table, we have to welcome them to the science table, and we have to change the nature of the scientific debate. And I think we're beginning to see that in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, not only in the fact that that organization will be co-hosting a conference on cities and climate change next year with numerous other city-based networks, UN Habitat, UNEP, which will focus on issues of cities and climate change. We see a strong commitment from the scientific community and indeed the panel to include cities strongly in all products of the IPCC. So we're already seeing the remit of cities broadening and changing, and that's very important to me in my day job, because essentially without knowledge I'm unable to take decisions. And certainly at the local level, we as local government officials have no choice. We have no choice around whether we mitigate or adapt. We have to do both. We have to do both efficiently, and we have to do it now. So we work at a timeline that is very different to the long-term climate negotiations, which can afford to wander on into COP23 Unfortunately, I have about 23 minutes for each decision I'm asked to make on a daily basis. So it's a very complex ecology. There is no silver bullet here. It requires many people at the table, and unfortunately, the last people to be welcomed to the table are generally local government, and yet they are the key implementing force. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Deborah. Aroma Revy, who is the coordinating lead author of the IPCC special report on 1.5 degrees. Aroma?
Just to pick up from where Deborah left off, I guess local governments, along with a whole range of other players, are probably the most critical force in trying to get us anywhere close to 2 degrees, and probably the, you know, the critical people who might be able to get us to 1.5. And we heard this morning about how 1.5 is absolutely existential to, of course, the small island development states. We heard what, you know, we heard that very clear message coming in from Fiji and a whole range of other Pacific countries and other places. And also, we didn't hear that very clearly in the morning, other least developed countries, because drought, for example, and flooding, and a whole range of things that directly impact on the livelihoods and food security of a large number of people are quite critical, and that 1.5 story is tied to that. Within Australia, of course, we know the story of the Great Barrier Reef and the big challenge not only the Queensland economy is going to be dealing with, but one of the remarkable sort of ecosystems on the planet is really literally going down the tubes. So it's only when we are able to coordinate climate action with development activities, that's what I talked about in the morning, the integration of the Sustainable Development Goals, the energy goal being quite critical. And one thing that often doesn't get talked about on the energy goal is that we do need to be able to provide basic energy services to maybe 500 million people across the world. So that's not very clearly articulated in the climate story. It's all about decarbonization of cities and countries which are at, you know, 10, 15 tons per capita. But if we don't actually enable the opportunity to deal with climate energy justice and poverty, it's not going to help, because we're all tied into the same aperture system. So if countries where people are trying to make a living, to get livelihoods, and who absolutely are not connected to the grid, like in India, 350, 400 million people don't have grid connectivity, they will obviously both want and have the right to access that electricity. So one has to find ways of doing that. The good news, of course, is with urbanization sweeping across Asia, Africa, and of course, some residual parts of Latin America, much of what needs to get done is yet to happen. So if we do the right things now, that could actually make the fundamental difference between actually going down the tubes reaching a future which is closer to 2 or maybe 1.5. But I guess the story on the 1.5 is that, you know, we can do all the interesting stuff we need on the mitigation side. We might, at least on the carbon emission sides, have to look at other dramatic technologies, especially what are called negative emission technologies, but they're very interesting and complex trade-offs. So if you're talking about, let's say, biomass-based solutions and biofuels, in some parts of the world, they directly come into conflict with food and water security questions. So it works in some parts of the world, but doesn't work in others. So there are no sort of universal magic bullets, like Deborah was saying. You have to look at context, and hence this whole territorial approach that we're talking about just now, when you're looking at a city and the surrounding settlement systems and the regions around that, is very, very important. But if one integrates development process and so-called sustainable development process with climate action, you actually get a whole range of synergies, plus it becomes much cheaper if you actually do it now rather than wait 20 years and integrate loss and damage and all the adaptation measures that we'd like to deal with. I think one of the other critical sort of messages for Australia is we talk a lot about, you know, the mitigation side of things, but actually Australia is a world leader in adaptation action for a long period of time. So that's going to happen because we may have an overshoot. And if one prepares for it and one takes the best experiences there are in dealing with drought or flooding, and you know, you have a mix of both of those, plus of course high temperatures and a whole range of other processes, I think that might be a way forward. So it's not only the least developed countries or the middle income countries that look at adaptation. I think we have to prepare for adaptation now within the OECD, because some of this stuff is unfortunately going to happen.
Thanks, Aroma. Kevin Austin, who's the Deputy CEO of C40, which is the organisation that was started by the then Mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, to engage mayors of major cities, and I think there's now around 90 cities, to battle climate change. Kevin.
So following on from Deborah and Arrow, I mean, if you look at cities, the cities are cause of many of the emissions, but also a solution. You know, 54% of the world's population live in cities, 85% of GDP comes from cities, 70% of the world's emissions. So we have to focus our activity on cities, working with business, working with national government, working with states, working with citizens. We all need to work together. So the work that we did last year that we published in at our summit in Mexico City in December, which was our Deadline 2020 report, identified what cities need to do in order to be able to abide by the Paris Agreement, i.e. cities can put their amount in relating to Paris. This means on average, cities have to reduce their emissions from about 5.3 tonnes per person today to 2.9 tonnes by 2030, and all cities need to be carbon neutral by 2050 or earlier. And this is both an immense task and an urgent task. You know, cities have to change radically the way they operate, the way people live and act. And it's not a question of just picking the low-hanging fruit, doing the easy things. Politicians have to really make a stand and do things differently. And as part of that, we are working with all our cities, all 91 cities, to ensure that they have a zero carbon plan in place by the end of 2020. And if cities don't want to do that, they won't be part of C40. The first eight C40 cities are going through the process now, and that will be completed early next year, and that does include Melbourne. And we're really excited to be supporting these cities, but also then helping them implement the measures on the ground, because clearly, you know, it's all very well having a plan, but it's very important to have actions that result in reduced emissions. As Arrow said, they also present a whole range of other benefits, including improved air quality, improved health, jobs, reduced inequality. Measures that are important for citizens today, as well as for their children and grandchildren. And I think just going back to what John said earlier about President Trump pulling out of the Paris Agreement, I think cities also can play a very important part, both on the national level within the USA, but also on the international level. For example, you'll be aware that President Trump, when he announced pulling out of the Paris Agreement, said that he represents the people of Pittsburgh, not Paris. So through C40, our chair, Mayor Hidalgo, Mayor of Paris, wrote an article with Bill Pedotto, the Mayor of Pittsburgh, where they both said, if you want to do right by Parisians and Pittsburghers, you have to abide by the Paris Agreement. It's absolutely vital to guarantee the future health, well-being of citizens of these two cities, but citizens of the world as well. We have to work together. And related to that, 50 of our cities turned their monuments or city halls green in respect for the Paris Agreement to drive ambition on, despite the USA pulling out of the agreement. And 52 of our mayors issued a joint statement at G20 saying cities have to be a key part of the solution and the world leaders need to act with us. And whilst it might not have been the main overriding fact, the fact that 19 of the 20 leaders at G20, excluding the President of the USA, reaffirm their commitment to the Paris Agreement, and in many cases, countries have actually going to, when they're looking at doing the change in the NDCs, will actually increase their targets, shows that that does not impact on an international scale. And finally, within the USA, you know, we're working with 300 mayors of cities who have reaffirmed their commitments. They are working together to ensure that the USA, whether it's business, universities, social groups, cities and states, work together to commit to the Paris Agreement and to add together their emission savings in order to meet the Paris target, regardless of whether the federal government plays a part on that. And if you consider that California is the sixth biggest economy in the world, add New York City, it comes to the fourth biggest economy in the world, add a few businesses, and you've got an unstoppable movement to deliver this. So I do think there's an opportunity here, and there's no alternative.
Thanks very much. We're now very honoured to have French Senator Ronan Dantec with us, who, as well as being a senator for France, is also the climate spokesman for United Cities and Local Governments, a Global Cities Network?
Thank you. Maybe it's important to understand that it was a long work to reach the recognition of all of local government in the UNFCCC negotiation. And Deborah participated to this lobby. The first step was to have this recognition in Cancun after Copenhagen. Five words in the text, including local and subnational government. And I don't know how many hundreds of meetings for five words, but it was the first. The second step, and it's I think the most important step, was in Paris. In the Paris Agreement. It's not just a formal recognition. In the Paris Agreement, there is very, very practical paragraph about the role of local government with some methodology, technical expertise, all the initiative of the Lima-Paris Agreement, now GCA. And we have now the framework. And we are in the time of action. Everybody says that it's time to act. But how we do? How we do? We see that we have some cities who are very mobilized, very ambitious, as New York, as Paris, as Copenhagen. But it's rich cities. All the cities who have the capacity to decrease emission are cities with real capacity. And one of our challenges today is how we do with the other cities in the south. I think it's a key point for the next months or year. I take just one concrete example with the climate change and our world meeting and some coalitions that we follow. We defend, for example, that we use a green fund. You know the green fund, which is one of the decision of the Paris Agreement. We use the green fund to finance urban planification. It's not so expensive and with an important impact. And some cities have not the capacity today to develop urban planning in Africa or in other countries. It's a concrete proposal. We need to build some tools now. We have a big question of access to finance for some cities who have no capacity to have a loan. And with a very important interest rate. It's all these key points who are on the table, and we must work now about all these points. And I hope that the next COP in Bonn with the Fiji president will be the place to discuss all these very practical points. Well, not now in the time of commitment. We need always commitment. After Trump decision, it was very important to have this initiative of cities, regions, and big companies in the USA. Of course, it's an impact for public opinion. But behind, we need very, very concrete tool, and we are in this moment. And in this framework, it's important to have some meeting as EcoCity here in Melbourne, because somebody see what. Well, why they spend money to organize a meeting and the footprint of some member of the Climate Circus Tour. But it's important to exchange best practices. It's important to have contact between all the different stakeholders. We create dynamic and we exchange the best practices. In Lyon, 2 years ago, we have a world meeting about the role of local government, climate and territory summit. And the commitment of all the networks as C40 under 2 MOU represent at the world level around 2 gigaton less emission in 2020. And the commitment represent 13% of the inhabitants of the planet. 2 gigatons, 30%. If all the territory do the same thing, we are in the trajectory of the IPCC to respect the 1.5 degrees. It's important to have this idea that it's always possible to stabilize climate. Our question is to generalize the best practices. It is the key point, and in this key point, access to finance, it's key, access to finance for the cities and territory of the South first.
Thanks very much, Ronan. Finally, Victoria Mackenzie McCarg, who's the chair of Climate Action Network Australia and led the coordination of the Melbourne People's Climate March.
We're really thrilled to be here at this conference today with non-state actors from right across society, speaking from state governments, local governments, civil society and community organisations, because it's a clear indication that we are seeing empowerment and leadership from right across the community, regardless of the failures we may see from our federal government here in Australia. The Paris negotiation was a landmark moment for leadership and for unity globally. And that's something that's very much been taken to heart at multiple levels across the community. But important in that agreement was the fact that it does give agency to change and inspire change and activity at multiple levels. And while we have been very disappointed that the Australian government thus far has not stepped up to action in line with the Paris Agreement, that thus far is not acting as a handbrake to other levels of decision making in Australia. In fact, we see regularly investor groups, business groups, unions, civil society lining up side by side to not just demand further action, but to actually get on with the job of doing it themselves. And so this conference is a really great opportunity for those voices to come together and actually set the stage for the next steps of action that we will be taking.
Just open it up to anyone. Can ask any questions.
I just wanted to ask you, Mackenzie, and this is probably more to do with a state issue as opposed to city specifically, but the last week the state government released a paper saying it was opening the door to coal to build more jobs in the Latrobe Valley and whatnot. How do you feel about that when you're here at this summit and you're working, you know, people are working to reduce and get to zero emissions. How do you feel with the state government opening the door to more coal plants, brown coal plants?
I'm not familiar with the exact release that you're talking about from last week. I think one of the key issues we have seen in Australian public policy has been a real seesaw in leadership. We've seen that at different government levels. Australia saw very strong leadership from state governments in the early 2000s, which then disappeared when it looked like we might have federal leadership. Now that that's disappeared, we've got states and local governments stepping up again. We cannot afford that sort of seesaw. We need to see all levels of government acting at all times in line with the scale of change that needs to happen. We've been impressed over the last couple of years with a handful of our state governments here in Australia that have actually been stepping into that void of leadership, particularly in Victoria and in South Australia. And the Victorian government has shown some significant steps forward in both the way that they have handled the closure of the Hazelwood coal-fired power station, in setting up a just transitions package and process in the Latrobe Valley. But that's not to say that all problems are solved. Obviously, there are still significant issues with coal in the Latrobe Valley and in New South Wales and indeed in Queensland. And we see that the dynamics around coal and energy politics in particular in Australia is one of the most significant power structures and political barriers to action. We certainly wouldn't be welcoming any activities from any state governments that further entrench the role of polluting coal in our energy mix in Australia, or indeed for further exports elsewhere. And I'd be particularly concerned if the government was putting significant resource behind that. We are seeing really clear state government commitments towards renewable energy targets, which are filling the gap that exists in the absence of federal government leadership in Australia. And the collaboration, or the opportunity for collaboration across state governments to actually engage in that transformation of the energy grid is very significant. That said, we do still see a very significant gap from federal government leadership, because so many of the rules and regulations in that marketplace are governed by the federal government. And so we'd certainly encourage states and the federal government to be working together to move away from coal.
My question's for Aroma. I loved your talking about Auroville And I really would like you to describe a bit more that case study, how the ecosystem around the eco-services underpinned that city. Because I think we talk about eco-cities and we just think of more concrete, more fast rail, more decarbonisation, but it's that ecosystem behind that's got to be integrated. Can you describe that a bit more?
I do that, but I'm just sitting next to one of the leading ecosystems people in the world. So I guess the principle is relatively simple, and that is that if you want to have sustainable cities, they have to depend on the long-term sustainability of the ecosystem services that come from their surrounding regions. In Oregon, you know, over a long period of time, a generation of people actually put their lives into being able to regenerate and rebuild that ecosystem. And you know, it's not a small thing to be able to regrow forests, and you know, and they've done that with all these sort of impacts on biodiversity, water conservation. The water tables have gone up dramatically in that region. It's become much more productive. It takes time to do that, and it takes intelligence and it takes commitment, especially in a semi-arid or an arid region, which is what you see in much of Australia. So it's an inversion of the normal way that we try and plan and build cities. Because historically, the idea was you're in a frontier environment, you can go and set up anywhere, and you'll find the resources that you can bring to the city through trade or through pipelines or X and Y and Z. I think in a world that's actually quite full, or more than full with people, we have to invert that process. And that means reworking how we do planning, reworking our systems of education, and reworking our thinking about our relationship with nature. And that's a hard bit, because that's where values and process actually come.
Did you want to comment, Deborah?
Just potentially to underscore the potential that exists in Africa in that sense. We don't want to have to find ourselves in a situation where we look retrospectively back at the loss of those important ecosystems. We still have them, and that's the advantage of the African continent. The question is, how do you design a model of urbanization that allows those ecosystems to be designed in as basic infrastructure? And that really requires reconceptualization what urbanization is about. You know, Rona pointed out the huge challenges in terms of drawing those sorts of cities into the mainstream, because they are not cities that are going to be able to access, for example, the Green Climate Fund. They are largely informal, they're small scale, and so we're talking about an entirely different pattern of urbanization, of governance, and this is why you almost need a form of urban revolution, because a lot of what we're doing is basically sort of fiddling while Rome burns and not thinking about the real changes and revolutions that need to happen in the way we conceptualize cities. Because at one end of the scale, you've got the small informal settlements that are going to emerge as cities in Africa. On the other end, you've got something like Dhaka in Bangladesh, where I saw some projections will get up to 18 million people. That's not a city, that's something else. We don't have a word for what these cities will be and will become yet. And I don't think we're having that sort of challenging conversation yet.
At the moment, the financial ecosystem tends to encourage developers to build, certainly in Australia, skyscraper dwellings. They raise existing structures to the ground and build to the top. How do we encourage cities to preserve and extend what they currently have and not become a monoculture of huge tower blocks?
Well, modernism has its challenges in all dimensions, including in design. We know pretty well, and this is, I guess, you know, both in Australia and other places, I've seen, you know, so many inner city areas here, including the wonderful, I've seen Melbourne over the last 20 years, what we've been able to do inside the centre. So you can build a livable, walkable, much more humane city with moderately, you know, high densities. You don't have to have tower blocks to do that. And Europe has been doing this for a very long period of time, and, you know, so we know how to do this. You know how to actually build environments where the tallest buildings don't really go beyond the canopies of the trees. Yeah, I mean, but they're very dense, and because you have interaction, you get all the scale advantages that cities have in terms of economies of scale, but you also get the economies of scope that come from community. Because like I said in the morning, cities also have, you know, negative outcomes. And what tower blocks do create for you very often, and we've seen this starting in the United States and other places, is that they create dystopias socially. We have places in Bombay, for example, where people in informal settlements are put into tower blocks that are 20 stories high, with 2 meters between two tower blocks. And they become really difficult places for people to live in and work in, because these are working people. And when the lifts stop working and the electricity goes down, I mean, they're terrible places to live in. So the imaginations that came from, let's say, the Charter of Athens, it was useful at a point of time, but I think it's it's seriously challenging at the current point.
Any other questions?
This one is for Mr. Dunchek. It's a bit of a broader question. What do you think of the federal government's, the Australian federal government's action on climate change as it currently stands?
The federal government here? Yeah.
Yes.
It's my first visit in Australia. But of course, I know that you have some difficulties with your federal government to tackle climate change, but they don't want to go outside of the Paris Agreement. It's very important. I think it's necessary to be pragmatic. First, they stay in the Paris Agreement. It's a difference with America. And second, if we have a strong dynamic of non-state actor, of regional cities and some companies, at the end, it is this dynamic with the most important thing. And in few years, maybe a new government. When are your next elections? 2 years. It's a very short time. Maybe the next government want to be more active in climate action. I think it's very important the situation in America. The decision of some government, as California, some other region, to continue to decrease CO2 emission with a strong deal with Google, with Amazon, with all the big companies. It's a large part of the work to decrease CO2 emission. And we can imagine that the next government return to the Paris Agreement. We must see how it's possible to return, to go outside to return. I don't know very well, but if the concrete dynamic of action is good, of course we continue. Of course we continue. It's not a good news that Trump decided to go outside. It's not good, but at the end, we see that this mobilization in America give another message. For Australia, I don't know very well, but I think in Australia it's the same thing today. We have the dynamic of some region and company, and at the end, the government has no other solution to integrate the global effort. For me, the most important question is not so this question, than how we share the effort between the city, the region who have the capacity to do, and the other territory and the other actor. It's the same thing for the private company. There are some companies who have the capacity to finance their transition, and other companies not. How we do? This question of solidarity now, it's a key point, and for the next year.
And I think just to add on that, I think this has helped show people that shouldn't leave it up to the federal governments, the national governments, to do everything. And it has emboldened cities, states, businesses, social groups, universities to actually say, well, we can take it in our own hands and make a difference. And I think whilst it's started in America, I think that can be spread over the world to show that it's not national governments that can do everything, it's individuals, and we need to work together to kind of make a difference. And I think that could be potentially the real change going forward.
I just add to what Kevin was saying. I think it's a serious strategic mistake economically, because the carbon industry, which oil, gas, and coal is a sort of central part of that, is a sunset industry. It's like a country or a large corporation investing in telegraph lines when the telephone has taken over the world. So it's a question of time in some senses. And I think the irony for people to look at it from the outside is that the largest industry that we have in the world today, which is the fossil fuel industry, is about to go through a very dramatic transition. It will take some time for that to happen. But they're already very large players, national and corporate players, who are preparing themselves to make that transition. The most significant player is China. China has 70% or more of market share as far as photovoltaics are concerned, maybe two-thirds of the market in terms of wind turbines. And correct me if I'm wrong, but Chinese technology in the photovoltaic business has been built out of Australian technology. So in a sense, it's one of the greatest missed opportunities for the Australian economy and Australian business to let, in a sense, your intellectual capital and 20 years of work, which was not done in America, because Ronald Reagan shut down the US R&D in photovoltaics, to be taken over. So you cannot then give up your number two and number four exports, which are coal and gas. I mean, you had it in your own hands. And if through public policy or by mistaken sort of opportunity on the corporate side, you miss that opportunity, you know, with 20, 25 million people, you're not given these second chances very often in a rather competitive global economy. So I think it's short-termism in just in terms of economic interest. Forget about the other nice things we're talking about.
Maybe just to complete, about China and tomorrow, a CO2 market in China. It's the same market in Europe and in some region in North America. Maybe tomorrow, if we have a common CO2 market between China, Europe, and some region in North America, the question is if it's this market represent an opportunity to have better economic exchange in this area than in other area. And if, for example, Australia stay outside of this market, maybe they are outside of some other economic exchange too. It's not sure, but it's an hypothesis today.
If I could get you to clarify exactly what you said was a serious strategic mistake.
I don't have all the facts, and I think there are lots more experts.
But just what exactly?
But my sense is the following. I'll try and explain it very simply. Is that the China's photovoltaic revolution essentially sits on the back of Australian R&D and technology. So again, I can see people nodding their heads, you know more about that than otherwise. They have currently built a multi-billion dollar industry, which is going to become a $1 trillion industry around photovoltaic renewables, which is based out of technology that's come from here and an investment that's come from here. I know Australia is a very open economy and that's a great, great, great way of doing things. But the strategic question that you have is your number two export, as I understand it, is coal, and the number four export is natural gas. So if you want to transform your economy, apart from all the wonderful things we're talking about of transforming cities and reducing carbon, whatever it is, you have to transform both your export side otherwise. So you have the opportunity of becoming one of the largest producers of renewable photovoltaics in the world, because the technology was yours in some senses. Yeah? And you know that's an immense market opportunity. You look at the per capita gains that will be done per person, it would have been huge. I mean, let's say, if you had done the equivalent of what Norway did with its strategic oil reserve. Norway took the gains from a strategic oil reserve, they put it into something else, and, you know, they're doing wonderful things with it. So you have to be sort of imaginative on the financial and the economic side also, to try and see how you can use these things.
I think one more question, and then we'll hand over to Tanya.
I really want to ask you this. On those IPCC graphs that everyone has seen, there's always a path going straight up, which is, you know, runaway climate change. There's another path that comes down, which is called recovery. I've only ever spoken to one scientist who could actually see what recovery might mean, what the next 80 years might entail for us. And I still don't really get what an eco-city looks like. I haven't really seen an eco-city. These pictures behind, they look like dystopia to me. I would like to know your best examples of cities that, what it would look like, just the basic outline.
They actually have a much better story on that. What, everything becoming like Copenhagen?
Well, yeah.
Going from Houston to Copenhagen in less than half a generation, yeah?
That's right, yeah.
I have also interviewed people in Pakistan who had 50 degrees temperature over several days,
yes.
And they were just hoping to put in some shade trees and free water for for people. So this is what we are looking at on that.
Well, at 50 degrees, because I have also lived at close to 50 degrees, you can't do too much. And 50 degrees, you're in pretty deep trouble. And you can't do anything with passive technologies at 50, you have to go to active technologies. And typically what happens in that case is that, you know, the best or the worst known technology is called air conditioning. And that quadruples your energy demand, which means you're part of the problem rather than part of the solution. So basically we can't go there, or we shouldn't go to places that are going to be at 50 degrees. It's impossible to live in those environments, because it's 50 degrees plus, urban heat island and whatever. But no, they have a much clearer articulation of it.
I mean, if you take like a Houston of this world, Houston or Barcelona, about the same number of population, about 2 million. Houston's 10 times the size of Barcelona. So we have to do a whole range of things that Copenhagen have taken 40 years ago. And 40 years in Copenhagen, they had cars filling up the streets, they had all their squares were car parks, things like that, and they've taken 40 years to change the culture. And we're looking at, for example, Beijing sort of 10 years ago, where they had an active policy to take bicycles off the streets and put more cars in. Fortunately, they're now changing that. But we have to do pretty much everything in the book relating to urban planning, both now and for the future, because the things we do now in urban planning affect the world and affect the cities for generations to come, for transport, for waste, for building energy efficiency. And you have to put them all together in a compact city, a city that's coordinated, a city that's for people, but dense, as Ariel said before, a city that's green to deal with the adapted to climate change relating to drought, heat, floods, etc. And you've got to do it quickly. And to kind of Ronan's point, this means you've got to break down the barriers that exist in cities at the moment. Lots of good schemes, lots of money out there, but there's nothing to join the finance together, so finance. We've got to get over the financing side of things. The second thing is we've got to get to deal with the issue of governance. Even in the most developed cities of the world, there's issues to do with how we relate to state government, national government, etc. Equally, how cities can work. Again, even the most developed cities of the world, and I was in the mayor's office in London for 12 years, they are still siloed. But in the developing world, it's even more difficult. And the third thing we have to do, and do quickly, is deal with the leadership issue, making the case. It's no point in saying, we're going to put taxes on your citizens, we're going to put regulation on the citizens, and your grandchildren will thank us. It's not going to work. So it has to be, how do you deal with the other benefits? How do you make the air clearer tomorrow? How do we improve health? How do people get to work 20 minutes earlier? How do we make sure we create thousands of new jobs and prove that the actual clean tech sector are the jobs which will come, not in the fossil fuels industry? And Portland, Oregon did that brilliantly when they managed to stop fossil fuel tanks and storage. And that would create 400 jobs. They said 50,000 jobs are in our green tech industry. This is what's important for Portland. And these jobs relate to high quality jobs over $20, where you don't need a university degree. So we've got to transition that. We've got to do it on the basis of the opposite, the Trump line, the new jobs, the jobs for the blue-collar workers will be in green tech, will be in our cities. So I think we can look and aspire to Copenhagen, but we have to get and solve and deliver all these barriers in order to move forward.